Hey, welcome to IKEA, where even this desk is circular.
Huh. How so? Looks pretty rectangular to me.
It's because we're always looking to repair, reuse, and relove our products, like buying back your IKEA items for store credit. Or shop our as-is section for great deals. You can even order free spare parts. Get on the circular path for a more sustainable future.
Still a rectangle.
Get started at IKEA-USA.com/circular. Visit IKEA-USA.com/circular for as-is information and buyback and resale terms and conditions. Spare parts not available for all products.
Today on the show, we are braving the elements of Seleucia Secundus and fighting for our lives. Oh, also, we're just 9 years old.
Welcome to Gom Jabbar, your guide to the iconic world of Dune. We'll be exploring the themes, philosophies, and characters found in the sandy depths of this vast universe. From Frank Herbert's groundbreaking novels to the adaptations on film and TV. My name is Leo.
And my name's Abu.
And man, we've had a tough childhood fighting for our lives since we were like 5 or 6 years old.
Wrestling tigers. Yeah, it was a rough upbringing. But now we're the best of the best, Leo.
Tony the Tiger has a whole different connotation on Seleucia Secundus. Tony is the tiger you like stab and kill as a child.
You train your entire adolescent life to murder Tony the Tiger.
It's Sardaukar. Sorry, that was bad.
Well, if it isn't obvious, today we're talking about the Sardaukar.
Yeah.
Who are a pretty significant force in the galaxy. And I think throughout this episode, we'll make the case for them being one of the most important sort of groups in the entire Imperium. And this is something I didn't realize before I started doing the research for this episode.
Yeah.
Like, for as important as they are, the Dune novels don't explain them very much. They're just sort of there.
I very personally wanted to do this episode because... for myself, as I was reading Dune for the very first time, I remember seeing this word, Sardaukar, Sardaukar, Sardaukar.
Yes.
And never knowing what it is. And I kept thinking, oh, can't wait till, you know, Frank Herbert fully explains
right. This
whole thing. And then the book ends. And I was like, what? I still don't really get it.
Right.
And the way that characters talk about them, I felt like I was missing out on something
right. That...
Again, I kind of only now really appreciate having done this research. So I am very excited to talk about this.
Yeah, and that's sort of our goal today. The whole point of approaching the Sardaukar from a non-spoiler perspective is if you are about to read the Dune novels or if you're excited about
right. The
upcoming right. TV show and films, we're hoping that this episode will give you greater context as you enter this incredible world of Dune. Because we were certainly lost every time the Sardaukar were mentioned
right.
on our first read. So hopefully this will help you on your first read and will give you a greater picture. But no spoilers today for any of the novels. Yeah. We will discuss the history of the Sardaukar, the context of who they are and what they do, but we will not be talking about the plots of the books. And we will effectively get you caught up to speed with the Sardaukar up to the start of the first book, and then we'll stop. So then you can pick it up from there and enjoy it, having understood, hopefully, after we do our jobs here, having understood who the Sardaukar are and why they are so important.
God, as tempting as it is to just talk about everything, you're absolutely right. We'll hold off. We'll be good.
Yeah.
So let's start off. Who are the Sardaukar? What do you think? How would you describe the Sardaukar?
Badasses.
Yeah.
In one word.
John Wicks.
Yeah.
Jason Statham's.
Yes.
They are.
Yes.
Dwayne Made of Rock Johnson.
Mm-hmm. Leonidas of the Spartans.
Oh, yeah. That's a good one.
There's going to be a lot of Spartan analogies today. But what we're getting at, we are beating around the bush here. The Sardaukar. the Sardaukar are simply the elite military force of the Emperor. And they're arguably the best fighters in the entire galaxy.
Yeah.
And it's due to the Sardaukar that the Emperor has been able to hold the throne wait for this fact, for nearly 10,000 years.
It's a casual amount of time to hold a throne, you know, this one house in power. And you're totally right. Like, they are arguably the best fighters in the galaxy, and that's kind of their reputation, which is part of it.
Mm-hmm.
Many times in the history of Dune, before the first pages of the books, they demonstrate themselves to be some of the greatest fighters ever. But a lot of the times, there's sort of this dissuasive force. They are...
Yes.
People go, oh, the Sardaukar? The fucking Sardaukar here? I don't want to fight them. That's terrible. No, okay, I give up. You know, you keep being the emperor for another 5,000 years, whatever. It doesn't...
Right.
You know, they are a big part of why House Carino is in power for as long as they are.
Absolutely. I mean... Be realistic, Leo. Would you want to fuck with an army that's made up entirely of SEAL Team Sixes?
No. Didn't even need to hear the end of that sentence. We're talking about Sardaukar. You said, be realistic. Do you want to? I said, no. I opt out immediately if the Sardaukar are going to be present. They are ruthless. They are cunning. They are, like, religiously motivated.
Right.
And again, all of this stuff is... part of the reputation, but it's also totally justified. You know, you're not fabricating much. You're just saying, wow, look at what they did.
Right. And time and time again, the Sardaukar will be mentioned throughout the Dune novels. For me, at least, when I was reading these chapters and people would bring up Sardaukar, in my mind, the scene would play out where people would sort of talk in hushed whispers, right? Like nobody right, nobody right. dare say the word Sardaukar out loud in case they're right around the corner ready to fuck you up. Like the Sardaukar are to be feared when they're referenced in the novels by the characters. It's almost an awe. And you're absolutely right that they're a deterrent force. The Emperor's like, if you're going to fuck with me, you're going to have to get through the Sardaukar, and nobody is either able to get through the Sardaukar or even wants to try because of this reputation that they have for being such ruthless, such proficient fighters.
Yeah.
And we're going to dig into why that is, where we're going to really dig into their history, what makes them such ruthless and incredible fighters, and how they rose to power. Cause it's a really fascinating history.
It's funny cause the way I agree, as you're reading the books, they are mentioned in these sort of hushed tones. I always got the impression of, like, Beetlejuice, like, you don't want to say it too many times, or they'll appear, or, like, Death Eaters, or, like, Voldemort, like, you just don't even want to say the name, but the way you described it makes them sound like they're the jocks at school, and you're, like, in the school halls, meanwhile, they're just around the corner, like, oh, I'm gonna take his lunch money, brutally and with religious fervor.
Right, look, Leo, I just don't want to get shoved in the locker again by Sardaukar, okay? The last time that happened, I was stuck in there for hours.
Your children felt it, you don't even have kids yet. Oh, God.
Yeah, it's crazy. Everyone's afraid of them is the point we're making. Their reputation precedes them. One thing I do want to point out, by the time we... So again, 10,000 years. You got to remember the scope of time here.
Right.
That they're effectively in power and that they are considered the best of the best. By the time we reach the first Dune novel, I got the impression that they kind of coast on this reputation. Like, yes, they're still an extremely formidable force, and are probably still one of the strongest military forces in the entire galaxy, hence the Emperor keeps his power. But I got the impression that they're not exactly like boots to the ground doing the dirty work every day. Like, just the fear of them is potentially enough to, you know, quell an uprising or get a rebellious minor house to fall in line. Just the threat of Sardaukar is potentially enough at this point.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
the myth of the Sardaukar has like demonized them so much.
You've got to imagine that even once you achieve this incredibly difficult rank of Sardaukar, you still are honed through combat. You are still honed through confrontation with people who are willing to fight you with the anticipation of maybe winning.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you're probably right. Again, the newly initiated Sardaukar are probably just as ferocious and capable 10,000 years later as they were 10,000 years ago because of the nature of initiation. But you've got to think that those seasoned Sardaukar warriors, they haven't seen real combat in a long time. So I don't know. What is there left to challenge you, and what is there left to kind of cut your teeth on and force you to improve past maybe where you have to be that deterrent?
Right. And that's actually something we want you as our listener to keep in mind here. This question of what is there left to challenge you? What is there left to sort of push you past your barrier, force you to do something, to push yourself to a level that you didn't expect?
Yeah.
If you are already the best of the best and everyone's scared shitless of you, like that is sort of the reputation that the Sardaukar have. And as we talk about their origins and the culture that the Sardaukar originally were formed in, you'll start to realize that it was their home planet. It was their brutal and deadly culture that sort of put them through the ringer. There's this quote that's attributed to Henry Kissinger. Not that I want to be quoting an asshole and warmonger like him, but this quote doesn't even make any sense because it's not true, but whatever. The quote says...
You're setting this up very well.
The quote is, "A diamond is a chunk of coal that did well under pressure."
Yeah.
And again, coal is not how diamonds are made, whatever. We don't have to get into the technicality of all of that, but the sentiment still stands, right?
Yeah.
It is external pressure. It is overcoming challenges that forces people to sometimes become the best versions of themselves or push themselves to a height that they never imagined. That is effectively the story of the Sardaukar. So we want you to keep this question in mind. As they grow to be this massive military might in the galaxy, do we think that because they have less external pressure and they start to become cozier as they become more powerful, or do they become softer? That's a question that we want to pose to you now. We're going to get into their origins here, and then we'll circle back to it at the end of the episode. And Leo, you and I think we'll have some thoughts to share about that. But keep that in mind as we get into their origins.
Yeah, totally. So let's get into it. We've talked a little bit about it, but let's get into it. In so many ways, the beginning of the Sardaukar is very clearly just the planet they're on, the planet they're coming from. Seleucus Secundus is a shitty planet. It's not...
to put it lightly, it ain't no Kaladin. It ain't no paradise.
If you were shopping for planets, you know, you're going on like an interplanetary journey and you're like, oh, I'm looking for a nice planet to settle down on, you would like nope the hell out of Seleucus Secundus in seconds.
Yeah.
You'd be like, this sucks. This is the worst.
Yeah, no. This is not the house that it's like a cute house flipping project for you and the partner.
No.
This is that house from that Netflix show, House on Haunted Hill or whatever that was.
Oh, yeah.
Where people fucking die. Like,
yeah.
That's Seleucus Secundus as a property.
Full of ghosts. Just super haunted. Whole place.
Absolutely brutal planet.
And I'm kind of joking about it, but it's true. The resources are almost non-existent. Like, pretty much the only thing's iron, and that even that's in like very small amounts. The temperatures range from negative 45 degrees Celsius to 60 degrees Celsius. So, bring your zip off like jean pants so you can like convert between jeans and shorts.
Yeah.
It's not good enough. You're still going to die. So great. But it's still like covered in plants and it has animals and stuff. And kind of as you might expect, they all are super tough, crazy, strong things because what you have to be or else you die. That's the nature of this planet.
As simple as that. Only the strong will survive here. Only the strongest plant life, only the strongest animals. And of course, only the strongest people.
Right.
And that's where the tribes of Seleucus Secundus come in. The early sort of tribal cultures here on this planet are constantly at war. There's very little pasture land. There's, again, iron is like the only resource you have.
Right.
Like, so there's constant fighting over the resources and the land.
Right.
And the result of all of this fighting is that the cultures evolve to adapt. The cultures become extremely warrior-like in these tribes. They're constantly fighting and on guard and training the next batch of, you know, soldiers so they can survive on this brutal, hostile planet. That becomes their culture. If you're not strong on Seleucus Secundus, if you cannot fight on Seleucus Secundus, you will die.
Yeah. The other thing, it's competition. And that this is what forges strength, right, is this pressure amongst the people who are already tough, resilient, strong, forceful people. who are fighting the elements and fighting mm-hmm. one another. You have these tribes and these groups that are battling one another. And one of these is very much the biggest and strongest, and that is the Sardau. Sardau?
Sardau sounds right.
Yeah, Sardau. Again, the first part of the word Sardaukar, so cool. We're halfway there, I guess.
They haven't grown up to be Sardaukar yet.
They haven't evolved yet. We got to get them to level 14.
Exactly.
Sardaukar!
Yeah, so the Sardaukar right. are the strongest tribe at the moment, and it's all due to their culture, which we're going to get into, because it's yeah. fucking brutal.
It's crazy.
It's not the kind of tribal family you want to be growing up in. But it, again, not entirely by choice.
Right,
it's
right.
because they live on Seleucia Secundus, this horrible, horrible, haunted planet. It's because they have to constantly be fighting for tiny amounts of land, tiny amounts of resources, that this culture becomes what it is. It becomes militaristic and it becomes warrior-like. And the Sardau are the best of the best here on the planet. What's important to note here, this template for Sardau culture becomes the paradigm by which the Sardaukar later in the Empire train their soldiers.
Right, right.
And that's incredible to think. This culture that was the result of basically a survival tactic on a brutal planet was the template to create the strongest soldiers in the galaxy.
Yeah. It's the cookie cutter that was like needed to survive becomes the template, right, for the most incredible warriors the universe has ever seen.
Yeah, the biggest bullies that'll push you in the tiniest of lockers, Leo.
They're so strong. They'll fit you into a locker that you look at and you go, there's no way I'm going to fit in that. And then they do somehow
they
fit
do.
You into it. It's incredible. They're masters. David Blaine would be impressed.
So let's talk about some of their culture. Let's talk about what happens if you are a youngin' in the Sardau culture.
You know, life is super easy. I think, you know, it's like super chill.
Yeah, you're just coasting, baby.
Coasting until, of course, you know, all cultures have this point where it's like time to grow up, time to,
right.
you know, arrest the power that lies within you. For the Sardau, it happens a little earlier than, you know, like I remember when I was like in my 20s, I was like, oh, now I need to be able to take care of myself a little earlier, maybe.
Right. Got to do my own taxes. Yeah. All
right.
of that really
yeah.
hard stuff.
Meanwhile, Sardau children over here, 6 years old, 6 years old. They are sparring with knives.
Hello.
They are knife fighting before they've developed their brains fully.
Insane. Yeah. Combat training starting at the age of six. And that's not necessarily unprecedented. Obviously, that's inspired by Spartan culture.
Right, right. Yeah.
And the Spartans also began training very, very young. They were also very much a warrior culture. And as we continue to talk about this culture, you will notice lots of similarities to Spartans. It's obvious that the Sardau and the Sardaukar were inspired for Frank Herbert by the real-life Spartans. And this is one of those parallels, the early combat training starting at the age of six.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, Leo, while they're doing this combat training, are they allowed to kill each other?
Yeah, I mean... It's
that hesitation said everything that needed to be said.
Yeah. it's not encouraged.
Yeah.
They're not really encouraged to kill each other. In fact, killing each other is bad because even like late bloomers, you know, oh, he's seven and can't knife fight yet, you know, give him some time. It's believed by the Sardau people that people, warriors, these boys, inherit their true power through the puberty experience.
Huh, I did too, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. Same. Yeah. Same. So listen, are we so different? That's the question. So from this age of six, right, they're knife fighting. They're encouraged, you know, draw blood, cool, whatever. If like little Tommy kills little Timmy, it's not great names that I just came up with, but it's okay. If little Tommy kills Brandon, little Brandon, the adults will be like, oh, we should probably keep an eye on this tiny murderer. But that's fine.
Yeah.
You're good. Just don't do it again. Let this be your like one murder before you're 10.
Right.
Yeah.
Slap
exactly.
on the wrist. Yeah. But it's not until after puberty that they are, given the green light to kill people.
Yeah. For a while. Like they're like, yeah, go ahead. Sure. You totally.
Yeah. Like puberty is where the start out believe, okay, now you should have, you know, you've been training for at this point, 6 or 7 years, you've hit puberty, whatever inherent ability you had should be out by now as a warrior.
Right.
And this is where it's kind of kosher for them to even accidentally kill each other during training.
Right. Right.
And in fact, killing another person is part of the early initiation tests into the warrior caste. Like you know, you don't necessarily graduate to becoming a full Sardau tribal warrior until you have taken a life. That's very much part of the culture. And this is a way to weed out the weaker children. If you cannot take a life, you know, if you trip and fall and die in a training exercise,
right.
we don't want you,
right.
you know, like you're not worthy of the warrior class. There's no way you'll survive on Seleucia Secundus. Like you can't go tripping around Seleucia Secundus.
We can't have elite soldiers who trip. I mean, we said that very clearly, and you tripped. It is worth mentioning two things here. First of all, they maintained a crazy proportion of adults to children.
Right.
Obviously, with all these like 16-year-olds dying, it's maybe not so surprising that there are fewer adults than there could be. But there are, like, I think it said something like 4 or 5 children to every adult.
Yeah.
Because they kind of anticipate a bunch of them dying. The other thing that I thought was interesting about this is they mentioned one of the things that would kill people is, you know, you get cut during training or you get stabbed or injured and infection kills you.
Oh, my gosh.
Or a weaker immune system kills you. And that's not okay. We don't want someone who's going to, like, get sick on the road, you know. So they are choosing the most resilient fighters, but also, like, kind of inevitably the most resilient people, too, who have the strongest immune systems.
Right, and weeding out the weak.
It is weeding out the weak in every way, right? If you're a super strong arm wrestler, but you get cold easily,
yeah.
then too bad. You're not going to make it into the Sardau fighting class.
Yeah.
Oops.
Yeah, I mean, not to get all Bene Gesserit, but yeah, it's like a way to weed out, like, the bad genes in the tribe. And let only the strongest and the most resilient survive. And this happens, again, very early. We are talking about children and teenagers.
Yeah.
And once they reach adulthood, they have effectively passed some of the hardest challenges of their lives and are now just the most brutal, bloodthirsty, and strongest warriors, you know, eventually in the galaxy. And it's wild. And one small note I think we should also mention. Yes, there are 5 children to every 1 adult Sardau, and that's because all this training that we've been talking about is for the boys, Leo.
Yeah.
The girls do not do this. The girls are for one thing only, and that's to have babies, to create more warriors for the tribe.
It's always the third thing people say about the Sardaukar, right? Religious fanatics, really incredible fighters. Super sexist, like crazy sexist.
Super
training for the lads, making the lads as big and tough and strong as possible. Meanwhile, the girls are just resigned to a life of creating more Sardau tribespeople. Yeah,
they're living on a planet where it could be 60 degrees Celsius tomorrow.
Yeah,
you need the population.
Right,
the faster people die, the faster you need to. Create more of them. So, you know, of course we're not justifying what they've done and it's a brutal tribal sort of backwards culture, but it's a result of the world they inhabit.
Yeah.
And that's the unfortunate part of it.
It's just a cold, calculated, totally unfair, really brutally, like very different from any of our values here on Terra in the year 2020.
We're a soft bunch, Leo. That's all. We're a bunch of Pillsbury doughboys.
We are soft.
Yeah, exactly.
But to be fair, we're
better than the Sardau in many other ways.
So many ways. I can draw pretty well. And Sardau warriors can
show me a Sardau artist?
Yeah. Fuck. Probably none. Probably none of them.
Probably none.
They all died the way that I would.
So let's talk about some of the some of the initiations and the tests that these right. children make. Right. One small fact that the encyclopedia made sure to point out, which I found shocking, was many of these children never make it past the age of 12. So brutal training, you reach puberty, and you just don't pass. You die. You get infected. You get sick. You catch a cold. There's a test that happens twice a year from the ages of 8 to 12,
yeah.
where these children are left empty-handed out in the wastes of Seleucus Secundus
yeah.
and left to either die or survive and make their way back to the tribe. So again, another way to just weed out the weak. And many of these children don't make it past the age of 12.
Yeah, it's true. It's just like Minecraft, but way darker. Just way more violent and terrible. It's impossible. There is a special challenge. So when they make it to puberty, there's like a fun kind of like
oh, nice.
Party challenge. It's like, oh, cool. It's a graduation puberty challenge. Yay.
Yeah. I think I had one of those too. It was called high school.
And you went to high school on Skull Reach, huh? Yeah. Cool. So boys are sent to Skull Reach. Skull Reach. Which, by the way, okay, Seleucus Secundus, shitty planet. Skull Reach, shittiest part of the shitty planet. This is just a bad.
Yep. Yeah.
So bad. It's, oh, wow. It is the worst. And these boys are sent there. Now, you might make the mistake of underestimating these, like, 13-year-old children. And go, oh.
You fool.
Probably a bunch of... Yeah, you fool. Probably most of them die during this point. Well, M. Night Shyamalan's present because 90% of them survive this fun puberty challenge.
Plot twist.
Exactly. At this point, the children who have made it to puberty, the boys who have made it to puberty, are so tremendously resilient that you can send them to the worst... imagine the worst place on Earth.
Yeah.
And consider the fact that galactically Earth is like a paradise. This is the worst place on the worst planet. Right.
Imagine surviving Florida.
Wow. I'm not even going to defend Florida. I just stunned the... Is that number one for you?
I think it's high on the list.
I was going to say like the bottom of a volcano or something, but you're like Miami, Tampa,
Tampa. Just imagine it. These boys are so hardy. These boys are so strong that they can go to Skull Reach. They can go to Tampa Bay, Florida.
They can go to Tampa.
And 90% of them make it back alive. It's incredible. Like
Frank Herbert was on a rough vacation to Tampa when he was writing about Seleucus Secundus.
Yeah, he's in Tampa like, fuck, is it 60 degrees Celsius here right now?
And last night was as nearly negative 30. Oh, God.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, exactly. What are we talking about?
I don't even know.
All right, back on track. Know, man. So, again, the point we're making is by the time these children get to adulthood, they are tough. And tough is not a strong enough word for what they are. This leads the Sardau to start expanding across Seleucus Secundus. And eventually, the Sardau win wars, fight other tribes, and become less of a tribe and more of a nation. They start, at first it was sort of murder everyone, take no prisoners.
Right, right.
But then they realized, wait a second, prisoners could actually be useful.
Keep in mind, even though these other tribes don't necessarily have the same crazy, exact same program for getting their kids so indestructible and crazy tough, every person on this planet is tough and resilient.
Yeah.
So you're totally right. Like the Sardau are like, oh, I feel like we're... wasting some super tough people. Like that seems like a waste. Yeah,
exactly. Right. The weakest 7-year-old on Seleucus Secundus could shove me in that same locker
today. Yeah.
Today. Yeah. Right now. Exactly. So again, the Sardau just happened to be the strongest and the baddest and the most brutal. They take over these other tribes. They start incorporating them into their now nation because they've spread so far and grown so large. And this is where the Sardaukar are formally created. So the Sardaukar are the elite fighting force of the Sardau nation now. And admission into the Sardaukar is even tougher. So now that there's all these disparate tribes, part of the Sardau nation, you would imagine there's sort of a overall weakening of the tribe, right? Like that,
right.
That strict original Sardau tribe training can't be spread across this many other tribes and people. So the Sardaukar now are sort of the best of the best of the best. And this is the elite fighting force, and admission to this group is given, again, to only the strongest of the people, the strongest of the warriors, and only the most fanatically loyal.
Right, right. Now, of course, all of this is creating this incredible, powerful force that is out there in the universe, but right now it's not really on many people's radar. This is all very, like, on Seleucus Secundus.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to get to this point where it's kind of introduced to the world, and or the galaxy. And the way this is done is through this battle. The Sardaukar end up fighting at what is called the Battle of Corin. And this is really the kind of the first time that you see the Sardaukar on the kind of world stage demonstrating, because they're fighting the Lance Rat.
Yeah.
Like, they are fighting all of the major houses.
The combined might of the major houses.
Right. And they technically win.
Crazy.
Like, it's a wild upset. You know, again, you imagine, like, one country's SEAL Team 6 taking on every other, you know, nation in the world in united power and winning. Unheard of, unprecedented in our world and our timeline, and also in Dune. So this is a massive moment in history.
Mm-hmm.
It was technically a victory, but it also kind of was a stalemate. Both sides,
right,
basically had to, like, it wasn't such a sound defeat,
or enough of a victory where the Sardaukar could just keep steamrolling, you know?
Right.
They
right,
had enough
yeah.
losses. It was a brutal enough fight against literally all of the combined might of the House Major.
Yeah.
It was a brutal enough fight for them that they had to come to the negotiating table at this point. And this is where the iconic, and we mentioned this in our timeline episode a few episodes ago, this is where the Treaty of Corin is signed.
But imagine being a Mentat on that day, of being like, I need more data about this thing. So tell me, the Sardaukar fought who? All of them.
All of them.
All of who? The other people on Seleucus Secundus? No. All of the other people everywhere. All of them. And they lost. No, they won. And the Mentat's like, well, I resign. I no longer know what's happening.
Is the sky blue? Who knows?
Who's to say?
Yeah.
Ask the Sardaukar. They know better.
It's an absolutely wild thing to think about. This battle, this treaty establishes, like, the modern world of Dune, like, as modern as you can call it. Remember, this happens 10,000 years
right,
before
right,
the
right.
first pages of the Dune novel.
The Battle of Corin is 88 BG, right?
Yes. Yeah, so on that timeline.
If you haven't listened to our episode one
right.
timeline, do, because it's good to know that.
Yeah.
That. It's good to know that. 88 before Guild, before the foundation of the Spacing Guild.
Yeah. So this treaty leads to a couple of changes for the Sardau people and the Sardaukar. The leader of the people at the time officially becomes the first Padishah Emperor. And this is where House Corin is officially established. This Padishah Emperor, this leader of the Sardau people, establishes his house as House Corin.
Right,
named,
right.
of course, after the Battle of Corin, which took place near the planet of Corin. It all makes sense. And this establishes the Imperium as we know it today, and quite literally establishes the line of Padishah emperors that, for the most part, except for a couple of rebellious people here and there, for the most part, maintain their power
yeah.
until the first pages of Dune, from 88 BG on the timeline to 10,000
yeah.
and some odd years to the first pages of Dune when we're introduced to them. They are still in power.
Right.
And it's all due to the might of the Sardaukar. And it's really interesting to know that this, according at least to the encyclopedia, which we consider sort of primary canon, Brian Herbert's books may adjust this House Corin origin a little bit. But as far as we understand the lore on this podcast from Frank's own words and from the encyclopedia, House Corin was originally the Sardau people, and they were established after their victory and because of this Treaty of Corin.
Yeah. And again, they are single-handedly wielding this weapon, the Sardaukar, for 10,000 years. we keep saying it, we keep going back to it, but this is a warrior practice of forging these warriors that is unmatched for 10,000 years. And even in the world of Dune, that is a long time.
Yeah.
So it is very worth mentioning.
Yeah. This warrior race that that House Khorne, that the Padishah Emperor now wields, becomes a tool, becomes a blunt instrument for the Empire's expansion. Their expansionist ambitions continue, and they continue to spread out through the galaxy, bring in other houses, and quell any rebellions. And one of those rebellions from a house who refuses to agree to this Treaty of Khorne and refuses to recognize the Padishah Emperor as the leader of the entire empire, create a confederation with like-minded sort of rebellious houses and allies called the Lishash Confederation.
And I'm sure it worked.
Yeah, exactly. We mentioned this because it didn't work.
Oh, no.
and it didn't work spectacularly. they had the encyclopedia gets into some minute detail here, but effectively the confederation, this rebellious confederation, has like one sort of minor victory against the Sardaukar because they were caught unawares. And then the Sardaukar fucking retaliate by wiping out planets.
That's crazy. That's so insane.
Like, they lost, like, one military base, maybe, and they're like, yeah, we're going to wipe out trillions of people. It's absolutely brutal. And the lesson that's learned here for the galaxy is, one, don't fuck with House Carino. This establishes them in a place of power. This establishes them as the leaders of this empire. And two, Sardaukar are scary.
Yeah, yeah.
Don't fuck with them either. And this confederation is like a prime example of what'll happen to you if you try to overthrow the empire or if you try to fight against the Sardaukar. And the only reason that every single person in this Lishash confederation, that every single ally wasn't totally just wiped off the map, is because one of the commanders in the empire's army literally put down his arms and refused to fight because he was so sickened by the slaughter.
Yeah.
And basically was like, I don't care what you do to me, Emperor. I refuse to fight. This has gone too far. This is much more than retaliation. These people have learned their lesson. They are pleading for mercy at this point. Yeah. They will accept our terms. Why are we still killing them?
Right.
And that's how far the Sardaukar take it. That's how far the Emperor takes it before finally stopping. It's just a prime example of why people are so afraid when you start reading the Dune novels, of why people are so afraid of the Sardaukar.
And why people are so unwilling to challenge House Carino. And like why the Padishah Emperor lasts for so long. And it's an example for us to bear in mind as we read the books, you know, as you see the word Sardaukar or as you hear the word Sardaukar, knowing this history helps. But also it's an example for everybody in the universe at that time where they say, hey, these warriors, the Sardaukar, they are invincible. The one time they had a tiny little loss, it spun all of this misery for the quote-unquote mm-hmm. victors.
Yeah.
So they are undefeatable. Even if you win like a tiny battle against them, you're never going to win the war, ever. And whether or not this is 100% true, This is really where that myth or that sort of story of invincibility is created.
Absolutely.
So at this point, as the years pass, as the centuries and thousands of years pass,
as the millennia pass,
right. What was initially this sort of raw fanaticism and, you know, surviving on Seleucus Secundus as the primary goal and these sort of like tribal elements, this tribal culture of the Sardau is nearly forgotten.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the mechanisms that we're still working with the same cookie cutter of how to take like children and make them into Sardaukar warriors. And we're also dealing with now, how do you, once you've defeated people or once you identify potential, how do you make that potential into a diamond Sardaukar warrior through pressure or whatever, Kissinger, right? Again, not how it works, but fine. So we are getting away from that initial tribal connection, that tribal culture, but we still have the mechanisms in place, this kind of paradigm equipped that is still creating new Sardaukar warriors and keeping the battle and the power at least alive enough. Again, not many people are challenging them, so it's a little bit hard to say, but the tribal culture is nearly forgotten at this point.
Right, right. Their tribal history is nearly forgotten. That's true. And Seleucus Secundus itself is now a prison planet. So now House Corrin, the Empire, the Emperor, when and if they fight battles and quell rebellions, prisoners of war and prisoners against the state can be sent to Seleucus Secundus, and they will have to do the same things that the Sardau children once did a long, long time ago. They will have to deal with the negative 45 degrees to 60 degrees Celsius climate. They will have to deal with
Tampa. Yeah, they have to deal with Tampa.
Exactly. They're going to be thrown to the wolves and thrown to Tampa. And this is what will forge them in the fire to become the next batch of Sardaukar for the Emperor. So like you said, that tribal culture and the maybe many of their tribal ways are no longer present for the Sardau and for House Corrino and for the people in power. But the lessons they learned from their own history and from their own origins are still very much at play. They know if you want to be the best, throw these people into the worst of conditions. Make these people survive or die. And that is how they continue to create more Sardaukar warriors and continue to create the best of the best.
There's some interesting conversations in the, or like writings in the encyclopedia about the perspective of prisoners of war who then become Sardaukar and how they are like then enforcing these things that were initially enforced upon them. But kind of happily, it's sort of strange. I think we don't have all of the intricate details of like how a prisoner of war would end up a Sardaukar warrior. Yeah, but it's just interesting because, yeah, you would think like, okay, I'm on a prison planet and they gave me a weapon and are training me and giving me opportunities to get stronger. That seems like not a great prison.
Right.
That seems counterproductive for you.
And you have to assume part of that is religious brainwashing too. You know, the Sardaukar are known for their almost fanatical religious like obsessions, and that I assume is part of the training at Seleucus Secundus. And again, all ties back to their own origins as the Sardau people, as their tribal lifestyle,
right?
Where their religion was to fight, their religion was to survive and to be warriors, and that all continues for these Sardaukar prisoners that are now trained on Seleucus Secundus. It all ties back to their origins.
So that's who the Sardaukar are. As you go into, if you're reading the books or if you are watching Denis Villeneuve's movies or the Sisterhood series, I don't know if the Sardaukar are going to be present in that. Just know, again, these are elite warriors forged in these insane fires of challenge and adversity. And they have this reputation that is every time it's been challenged has been reinforced. But you brought up a good point at the beginning of the episode, and if you're listening, maybe you've had some time to think about it.
Mm-hmm.
Does comfort make someone soft? Does ease of life breed complacency? Are comfort and complacency the same thing?
Yeah, I thought that this would be a interesting sort of wrap up for today's episode, right? Like we've given you the origins of the Sardaukar, we've explained who they are, we've explained why people fear them so much, and how they became the best warriors in the galaxy.
Right.
And the through line here sort of is what I mentioned earlier at the top of the episode, this idea of being forged in the fires of conflict and having to survive like every minute of your life. That is what made them so good and so strong as warriors in this galaxy. And the question here, and you know, Leo, you and I can maybe talk our way through this because I don't know that I have settled one way or another, but
yeah.
The question here becomes, are they the best because of that brutality? And could anyone achieve that level while also living like a better life, you know, like not being thrown out into the wilderness and having to survive at the age of 8? Like, could you still outdo the Sardaukar warriors by just like, I don't know, training really hard? Like, is there a level of motivation that you could achieve on your own without that external pressure? The thing that I keep coming back to is comfort isn't necessarily complacency, right? They're not the same thing. You can live a quote unquote comfortable life and have some of the basic comforts. Like, yes, I have food, I have shelter, I have a family, a support system, but you can still continuously push yourself to be better, right?
Right.
Like,
right.
We have high performing athletes. We have people who have exceptional abilities because they push themselves, and it's not because they were thrown out of their homes into Tampa, Florida, like at the age of 8 to try and survive.
Every Olympian, yeah, starts in Tampa.
Yeah, exactly. And it's, you know, like Roger Federer isn't the best tennis player in the world because he was he might have been training early on.
Twice a year, 8 years old.
Yeah.
Tampa.
And the argument could be made, like, can you reach like quote unquote peak performance? Not that this needs to turn into like one of those like obnoxious self-improvement podcasts, but can you achieve like peak performance? Can you become the best at something without some sort of like brutal external pressure?
Yeah.
The Sardaukar would make the argument, no, they've been proving it for 10,000 years. It took their brutal planet and their awful culture that treated women horribly and killed off most of their young boys to create the best in the galaxy and bring them to a position of power. I would argue that maybe you don't have to go that far, and perhaps there is a way to be both comfortable with the basic needs of your life, but also continue to push yourself to break your own limit. Would you agree?
Yeah. It's tough because there are things that I want to talk about that we can't because of...
Yeah, we are sort of tiptoeing around some spoiler stuff here.
Yeah, so I won't say any of that. But I will say that it is known that there are individuals who, in one-on-one combat, can best a Sardaukar warrior. In the encyclopedia, it is acknowledged in the encyclopedia that a Bene Gesserit adept can, in one-on-one combat, overpower a Sardaukar. Not maybe every adept and every Sardaukar. This isn't just universally speaking. But I bring up this example because the Bene Gesserit, and we can't really say too much about them, but they are not on Seleucus Secundus.
Right.
They are not being forged in the same fires as the Sardaukar warriors. And yet, on a very small scale, they are finding their way to this competence in confrontation. Now, that doesn't make the Sardaukar army any less the most powerful army in the universe. No one can challenge House Carino and the Padishah Emperor. But in one-on-one combat, it is, in very rare instances, known that individuals can.
Right. Exactly. So sort of going back to what I was saying about like pro athletes, like that's an individual achievement, right? Like that took a certain level of like pushing themselves. That took a certain type of person, probably a very type A person to do that. Yeah. Not everyone is winning gold medals at the Olympics.
Right. Yeah.
But you can be damn sure that if there was an Olympics for slaughtering the fuck out of people, a lot of the Sardaukar would be getting gold and silver. There's no right answer, right? We're discussing like this sort of philosophical point of whether or not you need outside forces to push you beyond your limit, or if you are capable of doing it yourself. And I think the argument we're trying to get at ultimately is like, yeah, you as one person could, but how can you guarantee an entire army of hundreds of thousands of soldiers will do that, and will do that at a reliable rate? And the answer is Seleucus Secundus.
The answer is Tampa, Florida. Seleucus Secundus. Why Tampa?
I don't know. I was trying to think of like states that are usually considered shitty, and Florida was just the only thing that came up.
So every article of like Florida man does this, Florida man does that, you're like, Sardaukar warrior does this, Sardaukar warrior bites neck of crocodile, you're like, yeah, typical.
Wrestles crocodile to the ground. Well, friends, there is no real ending. It's just the place where you stop the recording. But this podcast is always one step beyond logic, so help us spread the word of Muad'Dib and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. And be sure to check out the other shows on the Lore Party Podcast Network on loreparty.com. You can also follow us on Twitter and Instagram at lore_party. Thank you so much for listening, and remember, he who controls the podcast controls the universe. We'll see you on the Golden Path.